In recent years, dear friends, a system of thought, a system of philosophic thought, has won adherence in secular as well as in religious circles. And it is called by a rather difficult name, existentialism. It is a difficult term to define. For actually, the system which it covers is rather elusive and lacks logical precision. The secular branch of this philosophy has had as its chief the French author Jean-Paul Sartre. And this branch of philosophy frequently verges on what might be called intellectual and moral nihilism. But it appears to have passed its zenith among those groups of intellectuals who were attracted to it, and it is now definitely on the wane. But existentialism has won a considerable number of adherents in Christian circles for when that philosophy is translated into theologic terms, its main doctrines differ very little from those of Paul, Augustine, and Calvin, except that they are now accoutred in modern garb, in a modern livery, as it were, and seem to possess the authority of the latest in philosophic terminology. Now, basically, this system of thought is grounded in deep pessimism and disillusionment with life. Its mood is a mood of crisis, and its idiom is death. It maintains that man cannot and can never escape the predicament in which his existence is involved. His mind is entangled and caught up in irresoluble paradoxes. And his efforts at social reform and ethical self-improvement will never bring about the good society, the kingdom of God. It is even suggested that the very thought of man cooperating in the establishment of this good society is presumptuous, and is but another evidence of man's besetting sin of pride. A man's only hope in the world does not lie within himself, his efforts, his aspirations, but his hope lies simply in redemption by a power, not himself, by God. The chief exponent of this, what might be called religious existentialism, was Kierkegaard, a brilliant theologian of more than 100 years ago. Kierkegaard rebelled violently against the humanistic trends which he found among his Protestant theologic colleagues. He was contemptuous of all human effort at social reform and at self-reform. His own theology is dominated by a tormented sense of guilt and sin and dread and catastrophe, by a tragic view of life, of man's helplessness to improve himself. And in our own day, this system of thought has appealed to quite a number of religiously minded people. This pessimism underlying this system of thought has been deepened in our day by the disillusionment with the scientific and social and political movements of our day, which promised so much, but which we yielded so little, in fact, which yielded so much in terms of anguish and human suffering. Now Judaism rejects such an exaggerated pessimism as regards man's nature and endowments and achievements. According to Judaism's basic thought, man can, and to a large degree has, made his own world, and in spite of frequent and tragic setbacks, it has been a progressing world. Man has moved forward to more knowledge, to higher standards of living, to greater social justice, to better health conditions, to more intensive efforts towards the eradication of poverty. Judaism takes a wide perspective, an historic perspective of human life, and it does see man rising by the power of his will and struggle, aided by the grace of God, from the jungle of barbarism and slavery and poverty and disease to the higher places of enlightenment, of security, of justice, and of freedom. Judaism maintains that there is an ascending curve, an ascending trajectory, as it were, in the long evolutionary record of mankind. And in the eyes of our religion, pessimism is a form of atheism, for it ignores the creative spirit of God which is in man, which God placed in man. Now, it is true that man cannot see beyond the horizon of his times. What is ahead of him, he does not know. But Judaism has constantly reminded man that beyond all horizons, and each horizon, there is God. Our human ancestors, the human cave dweller, certainly could not see the shape of things to come. And in their dark, imprisoned minds 100,000 years ago and more, there already lay impounded, as it were, all the marvelous achievements of man that were to come. The inventions and the discoveries and the music and the poetry and the science and the philosophy, things which that man in the cave surely, in the first place, could not grasp, certainly could not anticipate. He could not penetrate the dark curtains which enshrouded him. He would have been justified, if he could think at all of these things, in a total pessimism about the future of mankind. But he would have been utterly, utterly, and completely wrong. He did not realize the capacities of his own mind. He could not. The reach of his own imagination. The power of his own will. He did not, because at that stage of evolution, he could not see the long corridors of time. He could not see how the minds of his descendants would push out in an irrepressible urge, push out like the flower in the sea, push out to see more, to understand more, to master more. He did not realize, that man who dwelt in the caves, our ancestor, that he was but a stage in a long and heroic process of human existence. A created being, but at the same time himself a creator, fashioned, and he himself a fashioner. He could not grasp the full play and the full glory of the human adventure, the epic of man rising on the rungs of aspiration, mounting achievements to breathless heights where he becomes a little lower than the angels. Were he able to trace in advance this primitive man, were he able to trace in advance the amazing odyssey of his descendants, he would not have despaired about the future of his race. The human story, my dear friends, is the story of the opening of windows upon life. And man himself has had to do that. Man himself has had to remove the dark shutters of his existence, ignorance, superstition, fear. Man himself has had to open wide the casements of his own life so that light might enter and fresh air. If man does not do that, if man had not done that through the ages, man would continue to dwell in utter darkness and then the dank gloom of ignorance and littleness and selfishness and unfulfillment. The human story, my dear friends, is that of the unconquerable men and women who are aware, but who at the same time are unreconciled to their limitations, their handicaps, their confinements, and their defeats. And they continue to beat and tear at the barricades of their lives, against the disabilities, until they give way, these disabilities, these dark shutters, the radiant sunlight of mastery, of enlargement, of realization. The human story is that of heroic men and women who, by their own sacrifices, either of self or of substance, by consenting to be despised and rejected by men for the sake of an ideal, who are prepared to become acquainted with grief and sorrow for the sake of an ideal, succeed in breaking the chains of other men, in lifting burdens from their shoulders, from their hearts, and in exorcising the evil spirits of fear and dread and superstition from the dwelling places of men. These are the prophets of mankind, the seers, the poets, the scientists, every seeker of knowledge, every teacher, every social reformer. These are the men who open windows upon life and enlarge man's vision and man's world. And now religion, good friends, has always challenged man to open windows upon life, to reach out, to rise up, to go forth, to go beyond. And God said to Abraham, Lech Lecho, get thee out from your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house to the land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation. And by replying to that challenge, Abraham became the founder of a new faith and the builder of a new civilization. God said to Moses, Ata, Lecha, come now, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh and bring forth my people out of Egypt. And because Moses accepted that summons, instead of remaining where he was in the comfort and the security of his dwelling place in the land of Midian, because he accepted this summons, Moses became the first emancipator of mankind and the pioneer of human freedom. God said to Isaiah, whom shall I send? And who will go for us? And Isaiah said, here am I. Send me. And by so doing, Isaiah became a prophet to his people and to humanity. And every prophet experienced the self-same call. That's what you speak of, a call of a prophet. The self-same summons. They were called away from what they were to what they were meant to be. And what were they meant to be? And what did these prophets call upon their people to be and to do? I, the Lord, have called you, I have taken you by the hand, I have given you for a light unto the nations, to open the eyes of the blind, to bring out of the prisons the prisoner, and from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. Open windows upon life. That was the challenge. The whole world recently celebrated the 75th birthday of a remarkable woman who at the age of 19 months was stricken, blind and deaf and mute. Helen Keller. If ever a human being was consigned to tragic helplessness and hopelessness and uselessness, Helen Keller was that person. Her story is well known to you, as it is now known to the whole of mankind. Her struggle upward to overcome her appalling and well-nigh insurmountable handicaps. Her indomitable courage, which sustained her through the years as she summoned every ounce of her spiritual energy and resources, trying to piece together an awareness of life about her, to link up through darkness and dread silence with the world of men and of nature about her, to recover speech while unable to hear sound, to educate herself, to go through school and college, to graduate with honors, to become a noted writer, to be able to found institutions for the care of others as disabled as she was. All this has become an inspiring symbol of courage for the whole human race. Helen Keller, literally by the power of will and faith, by self-challenging and self-summoning, opened windows upon the world for herself and for others. Now, she could have remained buried in her darkened world, a pitiful and self-pitying victim of fate, but she beat her hands against the doors and shutters of a prison house until she was able to step forth free and redeemed, take a full place in the world, step forth into the light of a glorious and purposeful and creative life. And equally remarkable, and equally heroic, and equally admirable is the life of Helen Keller's teacher and guide and companion, Anne Sullivan. If ever there was a human being who literally opened windows of life for another human being, it was this utterly astounding and amazing woman, Anne Sullivan. Anne Sullivan herself was almost blind. Later on, an operation partially restored her sight. And Helen Keller, her pupil, in her book Teacher, which is a tribute to her teacher, Anne Sullivan, Helen Keller herself tells the story of this remarkable woman who led her out of darkness. It is interesting that this Anne Sullivan herself had forcibly and with heroic effort to open windows in her own life. She was a daughter of Irish immigrants. She was born in squalid poverty. As far back as she could remember, she had had trouble with her eyes. Her mother died when she was 8 years old, leaving three children. Her father abandoned them 2 years later, and Annie never learned what became of him. Her younger sister, Mary, was placed with relatives. Annie and her seven-year-old brother, Jimmy, were sent to the state almshouse. Jimmy died a few months later of tuberculosis. No one outside was interested in Annie. She had no friends but her fellow paupers. Finally, after 4 years, she managed to escape by flinging herself at a group of visiting welfare workers, crying out, "I want to go to school." And at the Perkins Institute for the Blind that Annie learned Braille and the manual alphabet. And she remained at Perkins for 6 years more, graduating as the valedictorian of her class. This is the woman who had herself climbed painfully the steep stairway to self-redemption, who undertook the task of making the blind to see and the deaf to hear and the mute to speak to a degree that nature and the resources of the human spirit would permit. And her story has also been told. her nigh superhuman patience with this child, Helen Keller, whose unconscious rebellion against the unexplained afflictions of her life had made her wild and temperamental. The long, weary hours and days spent in teaching her pupil the manual alphabet to spell out words which meant nothing, until she was able to reach the consciousness of her pupil with the first word, water. Helen Keller describes this moment of miracle in her book. It happened at the well house, where I was holding a mug under the spout. Annie pumped water into it, and when the water gushed over onto my hand, she kept spelling W-A-T-E-R into my other hand with her fingers. And suddenly I understood. And caught up in the first joy I had known since my illness, I reached out eagerly to Annie's ever-ready hand, begging for new words to identify whatever object I touched. And spark after spark of meaning flew from hand to hand, and miraculously, affection was born. From the well house, there walked two enraptured beings, calling each other Helen and teacher. Ann Sullivan eventually taught Helen to read Braille. She taught her how words were uttered by having Helen place her fingers on the throat of Ann Sullivan, the lips of her teacher. And Helen slowly learned how to talk. And when Helen grew up, at the age of 16, she wanted a college education. She enrolled at Radcliffe. And Ann Sullivan helped her to prepare for entrance examinations. And Ann Sullivan sat with her in every class and laboriously spelled into her hand every lecture and classroom discussion. And Helen graduated from Radcliffe with honors. And she pays her teacher, who died, the following tribute. There was such virtue and power of communication in teacher's personality that after her death, I was emboldened to persevere in seeking new ways to give light, life, and yet more life to other men and women in darkness and silence. Teacher believed in me, and I resolved not to betray her faith. No matter what happens, she used to say, keep on beginning. Each time you fail, start all over again. You will grow stronger until you find that you have accomplished your purpose. Not the one you began with, perhaps, but one that you will be glad to remember. And who shall count the innumerable times she tried, failed, and then conquered. Here, my good friends, is the full grandeur and the nobility of human life. The opening of windows for yourself and for others upon life. And such people challenge us. Such people make us ashamed. of our own all-too-ready excuses for failure. Make us ashamed of our own loud complaining, of our own succumbing to the first misfortune or defeat or sorrow. Coming Tuesday, the American people will again gratefully celebrate the birthday of another human being who opened windows on life for millions of people, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln set free not only slaves, but set many free human beings, really free from their own self-imposed limitations, from their own unwillingness to open windows upon life because of self-pity or because of fear or because of pride or for whatever other reason. The whole world finds in the life of Abraham Lincoln a vindication of their own hopes and the promise of their own lives. For he too was poor. And oh, how poor. Poor in a vast, lonely, and empty wilderness. In the midst of a life that was harsh and crude and crushing. He too was born in the midst of ignorance and reared in the midst of ignorance. No schools, no teachers, no guides. An awkward child, an ungainly and uncouth youth, yet this man rose out of his world of poverty and ignorance and superstition, disabilities, by dint of effort, by dint of what must be called character, for character is the sum total of all that I've been saying this morning. I chanced to glance at the newspaper this morning, and I came across the following interesting story of the failures of Abraham Lincoln. Which he had to overcome. Abraham Lincoln lost his job in 1832. He was defeated for legislature in 1832. He failed in business in 1833. His sweetheart died in 1835. He had a nervous breakdown in 1836. He was defeated for speaker in 1838. He was defeated for nomination for Congress in 1843. He lost for a renomination in 1848. He was rejected for the land officer in 1849. He was defeated for the Senate in 1854. He was defeated for nomination for vice president in 1856. He was again defeated for Senate in 1858. He was elected president of the United States in 1860. Because of such men who are not reconciled to failure or defeat or disabilities, who are not content to remain all their lives in the little log cabin in which they had been born, because of such men and such women, who open windows upon life for themselves and for others. Because of these men and women who are filled with what the Bible calls the power of the Spirit, other people who walk in darkness come to see a great light. and those who dwell in deep darkness, a light comes to shine upon them. Amen.